This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
Here you had neighbors killing neighbors, priests killing parishioners, doctors killing patients, teachers killing students.
Starting on April 7th, 1994, Rwanda was gripped by a wave of unprecedented violence that lasted for 100 days. The state-sponsored extermination of the Tutsi minority by the most extremist Hutu factions in power resulted in an estimated 500,000 men, women, and children losing their lives. And while the genocide was prepared and manipulated by the state, the actual killing was carried out on a mass scale by hundreds of thousands of Rwandans who took up machetes, clubs, and farm tools to slaughter people they knew and people in their communities. And despite reports and images of the atrocities hitting headlines all around the world, the response from the international community was lacking, to say the least.
Everybody had pulled out and left them. Other African countries had betrayed them. Nobody had come to their defense. The lesson of the Rwandan story at that moment in time, in a sort of global sense, was that people who depend on the world for their protection are unprotected.
This is In the News from the Irish Times. I'm Sarah Chapalik. Today, the lessons of the Rwandan genocide still being ignored 30 years on. I speak to author and New Yorker writer Philip Gurevich, whose book, We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families, is widely considered to be the definitive account of the Rwandan genocide. Philip, can we start by stepping back to October 1990, when the Rebel Rwandan Patriotic Front, the RPF, which was made up mainly of Tutsi refugees, invaded northern Rwanda from its base in Uganda. Now, civil war broke out as they clashed with the Rwandan armed forces, and over the next 3 years, neither side could gain a decisive advantage. So in August 1993, an uneasy peace agreement is signed. But that all goes out the window on April 6th, 1994, when Rwandan President Juvenal Habyarimana, an ethnic Hutu, is assassinated. What played out over the next 100 days or so?
What played out over the next 100 days was systematic state-sponsored program of extermination of the Tutsi minority, a genocide of the most unambiguous and complete nature that we'd really seen since the Holocaust. And it was Habyarimana, the president who had been assassinated. It was actually sort of immediately after his assassination, there was effectively a coup where the military leadership of the most extremist Hutu factions, the Hutu power parties and actors, seized control of the state, put in what was called an interim government, but essentially it was the genocidal regime that lasted for just those 100 days. You know, many people sort of say, well, this was in some ways a product of the civil war that had preceded it, but in many ways it was actually a response to the peace. The real threat was peace to them, which would have involved power sharing and allowing the long oppressed and expelled Tutsi minority to both return and to partake fully in society. In many ways, the most distinctive characteristic of this was that while it was on the one hand state-sponsored, which is to say that it was mobilized by the state, it was promoted by the state, it was in many ways prepared and manipulated by the state, the killing was done very, very locally. It was done by mobilizing the masses. After the German concentration camps and the trains and all of these images one has of mid-century genocide, much of that was tied up in images of modern mechanization and the idea of mass industrial slaughter. And in Rwanda, what you saw was that, in fact, it was also about, here it was really about mobilization of people using often household farm implements that everybody uses in Rwanda all the time, machetes and hoes, and also clubs. Farm tools were used for a lot of the killing on a mass scale. And it was done by people who knew each other, which is very important. It was not done in this sort of anonymous way where you send people off to killing fields where masked agents of the state sort of, or anonymous, you know, people in uniform took care of the killing. Here you had neighbors killing neighbors, priests killing parishioners, doctors killing patients, teachers killing students. It was extremely intimate. And it was, in fact, down to the kind of cellular level that Rwandan societies organized in. You had an idea that people should be killed locally. It was actually considered a way of keeping track of people, making sure people didn't get away. But often if somebody was caught at, let's say, a roadblock a few miles from their home, they'd be brought back to their own home roadblock to be killed by their neighbors.
Sexual violence was also a huge factor during this genocide, wasn't it? How widespread was it?
There are different estimates. At the beginning, it was something people were underestimating, probably. And later, there was a UN estimate that basically seemed to implicate that the vast majority of Tutsi women would have been raped. And that seemed to be rejected by some of the survivors. But somewhere in between, hundreds of thousands of women were raped, and some of it was very systematic. Now, being raped and being killed were not mutually exclusive, but there were women who were kept alive in order to be raped. And there were also people who were both raped and killed, of course. It was widespread. And again, it was not hidden. It wasn't done in the street quite as much, but it was something everybody was aware of. And Rwandans use a term for this. They don't avoid the word rape, but they use the word sexual torture when they describe it, which actually I think is a very useful way of understanding what was going on.
Philip, early on in your book, which is called We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families, you write, and I quote, "As I traveled around the country collecting accounts of the killing, it almost seemed as if, with the machete, the masu, a club studded with nails, a few well-placed grenades, and a few bursts of automatic rifle fire, the quiet orders of Hutu power had made the neutron bomb obsolete." Can you tell me about when you arrived in Rwanda and what scene greeted you?
Well, I arrived a year after the massacring was at its peak. On the first anniversary of the genocide, it would have been April, I arrived in May, which is exactly a year after the vast majority of people had already been killed. And what you really saw was a country that was empty. I think that's what I was really referring to in the passage you just read. You saw a country where, for the most part, there were destroyed buildings here and there, but it wasn't the sort of images you see out of Syria or out of Gaza or something where, you know, leveling and bombardment, because it wasn't performed that way. Tutsi property was pillaged, and many homes were, they were mud homes, but they were anything that was, I mean, mud brick, they were adobe, were burnt and roofs were stripped. But for the most part, what you saw if you went around was an intact country. And even where there were mass graves, you know, you have two rainy seasons and it had grown over. It wasn't as if you saw the physical evidence of slaughter. What you saw was the absence in a country that had been the most densely populated in Africa. At that point, you had lost roughly 1 million people had been killed, in a population, I should say, of about 7.5 million to begin with. And then 1.5 to 2 million in the first months afterwards had fled. Hutus almost entirely had fled into exile along the borders of Rwanda. It was sort of surrounded by an archipelago of camps, these huge UN camps, where the Hutu power forces reconstituted themselves as well and threatened to return and finish the job. And then within the country, of those who remained, at least 40% were displaced from their homes in various ways. In their flight, the Hutu power forces had taken anything that they could carry or roll out of the country. The treasury and the banks and every business was left empty. They stripped the country. All the public transportation was gone. Most of the vehicles were gone. The water supply was, they stuffed bodies in wells and in order to dispose of them, but also to pollute the supplies. And they smashed up even the little tiny hand-cranked coffee bean shuckers that were used in the coffee plantations to take the pods off the beans so that you could take them to market. Just everything was sabotaged. And so you really had a country that was, the World Bank, right around the time I arrived, a World Bank assessment team passed through. Rwanda ended up being rated the poorest country on earth that year as a result of this. It hadn't been very high up before, but it was now the poorest country. And they privately told people, the term they used was, this is a non-viable country.
This genocide was unfolding. There were images and reports of the atrocities in the news. And yet world leaders like the US President Bill Clinton had no real appetite to intervene. In that case, there was a sense that peacekeeping operations didn't really serve America's national interests. I mean, where did that stance come from?
I would go further than to say that there wasn't an appetite to intervene. There was an appetite to avoid intervening. In other words, it's often described, even by people like Clinton, who has since apologized for it, as a failure. But in its moment, the American policy and the global policy to do nothing in the face of Rwanda and to get out of the way and let it go down was a successful foreign policy. There aren't that many policies that are well implemented. They decided we don't want to do anything, and they sort of resisted pressures to act. It wasn't just that they failed to get their act together to act. Washington was in many ways the leader of that, the Clinton administration, because America, as a leading world power, can kind of set the pace at these things, and had made a decision that if we don't get involved, others shouldn't. Some of that, it's interesting because Clinton came to office in this sort of post-Cold War moment with this idea of robust peacekeeping, and we're going to be involved in ensuring a good post-Cold War order that is in our image somehow. And in fact, it was in our image, but what we ended up with was the Somalia story, where you had the Black Hawk Down incident with 18 American military killed in a peacekeeping operation in Somalia, and then dragged through the streets. And that those images completely chilled Clinton's appetite for any kind of risk in the world. And you saw America in retreat. It was also under pressure to act at the same time, simultaneously with Rwanda in the Balkans and Bosnia and post-Yugoslavian wars. And again, resisted a great deal and took its time and dragged its feet for a long, long time. Out of that came this kind of idea that there were people who reacted to this failure to intervene or this decision to not intervene. And the only lesson was that we must intervene more and that we have to come up with new sort of reaffirmation of an interventionist ethic.
And then there was this next generation of politicians, Tony Blair, David Cameron, Nicolas Sarkozy among them, who had seen their predecessors' failings in this regard, and they felt that unilateral action was the way forward. There was also a sense that the UN Security Council was bogged down in the veto power of its five permanent members. That's the US, Britain, China, France, and Russia. So they went for this liberal interventionism approach. What was that like?
A mixed bag at best. I mean, the problem is, you know, before the early 90s in Yugoslavia and Rwanda, a lot of the doctrine in America was sort of was considered like this post-Vietnam syndrome, that we were afraid of intervening because we'd done badly. So you have the failures of intervention, and then you follow that with the failures of non-intervention. Then you go back to the failures of intervention. Some of the Bush administration people, for instance, tried to use the example of Rwanda and Bosnia as a justification for going into Iraq, which actually hadn't threatened, attacked in any way, imperiled us. And they went in and blew up this country. They went into Libya, different situation, but there was this sense that in the face of an uprising in eastern Libya, Gaddafi, the longtime dictator, would threaten a massacre and that they would prevent this. But immediately it escalated. You had mission creep, because the problem with interventions is the interests of the intervener very quickly eclipse the interests of whoever country you're intervening in, right? We as America, once we get our military involved, or the UK or France or anybody, starts to be involved in the interests of their military in that place. And then they start to wage the war accordingly. And then that becomes almost impossible to manage and to keep to scale. And you ended up with a complete catastrophe in Libya, and with us not being at all committed seriously to the aftermath either.
And Philip, are there any other examples of places where this type of mission creep took hold?
We did nothing in the face of the Syrian civil war. Now you could say that's a failure. On the other hand, it wasn't at all clear what might have been done that would have been terrific. And if you were comparing that then with Afghanistan, we did a great deal of intervening in Afghanistan, and we did not leave it in improved condition. I'm understating the matter. Where the problem is, you get people who sort of say, like, we have to do more. And others who say, well, watch out, you know, we won't. It's not totally clear that either extreme is defensible, but finding a coherent middle ground ends up pushing you back to the idea of, is the real debate always best framed as either sort of send in the Marines or sit on your hands? And it seems to me that there's a lot of levers that can be used in between. And even in Rwanda, people said, well, you don't actually have to necessarily send forces in to fight each gang of killers. You could, for instance, take out the radio stations that are directing a lot of the killing. You could put tremendous pressures here and there in Rwanda, as there often is. It's not like you also have a unified West. The French in Rwanda were sponsoring the genocidal regime. They're doing a lot of grappling with that right now on the 30th anniversary. They're revisiting that for the first time, kind of openly. They've danced around it a lot in official circles. Macron's spoken about it more clearly than others so far.
Coming up, I continue my conversation with Philip Gourievitch after this short break.
This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, creating a more friction-free office. Made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
Philip, I'd like to bring the UN into all of this, because in 2005, they adopted this principle of responsibility to protect, R2P, protect people from genocide and war crimes, even if that required force. We've referenced Libya in 2011. We've referenced Syria in 2013. In the case of Syria, the civil war has claimed over 350,000 lives, but yet many UN Security Council resolutions have been vetoed by Russia, who themselves invaded Georgia in 2008 and Ukraine in 2014 and 2022. So I have to ask, what is the Security Council's function in this regard at this time? Is it still fit for purpose in the way it was viewed a few decades ago?
I don't see it being terribly effective on these things. So, for instance, China. What is China most motivated about when the question of intervention comes up? Taiwan. So they're going to say, we want no intervention in the they consider their relationship with Taiwan as an internal affair. This was always a problem in Africa, too. For instance, during the Rwandan genocide, the African states in the African Union, their guiding foundational principle was non-intervention in the internal affairs of other states, which means if a country crosses the border to create trouble with another country. It's a little bit like what we saw with the first Gulf War. When Kuwait was invaded by Iraq, then the world says, no, 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 you're crossing sovereign bounds. But when Saddam Hussein wants to kill lots of people inside Iraq, we call it an internal affair. That's in some ways what the Security Council still defends, more instinctively than anything else. But it's a very weird institution. It's based on a sort of balance of power at the end of World War II. It was this balancing act that was struck. They have not been very effective at these things. UN peacekeeping has not been tremendously effective in most cases. The most effective things we've seen, I would say, in the last 20 years have been the periodic regional alliances. There was this thing, R2P, responsibility to protect, but that was always more lip service than substance. The fact is that one thing that's never happened in world history is purely, quote unquote, humanitarian interventions, that a country with no other interests, and this in a sense, Rwanda's like a kind of controlled study on this, right? Rwanda had no oil, it had no economic power, it's this tiny landlocked place that all it had were poor people getting killed, and not people that most people in the West were even aware of, much less identified with. And so that's, I think, a problem that persists, that we tend to respond to things based on our interests. In Europe, much of the response to the Syrian civil war or what was going on in Libya had to do with risks of immigration, right? That's when people start to feel the impacts and say, well, what are we going to do about this? The few places that you saw a kind of somewhat effective response was when they said, well, maybe this should be a regional problem. So NATO deals with the Balkans to some extent with what's happening in Ukraine. It's considered obviously on NATO's doorstep enough that everybody in NATO is concerned and knows why they're concerned. When East Timor happened in the late 90s, that there was this tremendous outbreak of political violence in East Timor, there was an Australian-led regional alliance that involved other forces from the Pacific area. But nobody was asking, I don't think, for troop contributions from France or Latin America or Africa. in Mozambique, Rwanda, or in Central Africa, or in Darfur, you have Rwandan and other peacekeepers now helping to try to like kind of manage those conflicts. And so those models have had more success, it seems to me, than the kind of Security Council driven international, because that's very gestural. I mean, honestly, if you look at the way America and probably other major powers have used the Security Council in recent years, if they really want to do something, they ignore the Security Council. If they want not to do something, they go to the Security Council and say, ah, we're hamstrung. The Security Council is a great place to go and look concerned without too great a risk of actually getting tangled up in it.
And it's difficult to have a conversation about both the UN Security Council, but also all this death and destruction over the past 30 years, and not acknowledge what's currently happening in Gaza. I mean, civilian deaths are rising. There doesn't seem to be any resolution in sight. There seems to be an inability to get past the arguments and counter-arguments about Hamas's atrocities and the legality of Israel's military campaign. Philip, with the hindsight of some of the atrocities we've been discussing, what are your thoughts on the current situation in Gaza?
In the most broad sense, the atrocity against civilians is very high. It's very awful. These situations are particular, and one thing that distinguishes it is that you have fighters who are also intermingled there, which makes it different than, say, just slaughtering neighbors. It is a different kind of thing. So you have a complicated situation. But the question is, where's the leverage supposed to come from? If it doesn't come from, I mean, the United States, in theory, could be putting a lot. I don't understand why we're selling arms to them, to Israel at this point. Then again, they're trying to manage this situation with Iran. And Iran is behind Hamas. Iran is behind Hezbollah. Iran is not visible all the time. Most of the coverage we're seeing explains that. I don't feel like I understand what's really in the heads of Washington when they're thinking about this. Are they thinking strictly about like how to manage Israel in Gaza, or are they thinking how to manage potential eruption of a massive conflict between Iran and other Arab states and Israel that would engulf the world in a much more terrible way? And we probably won't know for a while what's been going on that front behind the scenes. But I think that how one can manage this, if Israel is not letting people in, the only thing to do is to put leverage on Israel to try to diminish the extreme suffering that they are inflicting on the people in Gaza. I don't know where else there's leverage. The problem is that there's not coherent government and leverage of Hamas. You might also say in a conflict like that, well, you have to have a ceasefire where you're negotiating and you're having all, but it's not totally clear who's driving what there. And that's not reported about. People can't really get in there to report. Israel doesn't seem to want people in there to report. And it doesn't seem like Hamas particularly wants them to report on that side of things either. So I think it's an extremely difficult one, obviously. I don't think that it's for lack of the world being distraught at the spectacle. And it doesn't benefit most of Israel's allies and certainly Israel's critics. There are plenty of them in the Security Council. Israel's never been a fan of the UN or vice versa. But what you're seeing is just a terrible atrocity that for now is unchecked, as you see in Ukraine. The Russians have benefited tremendously by the post-October 7 situation in Israel and Gaza because the attention of the world has moved. The energy of the world leaders in, let's say, the Western world, even the NATO leaders, has been divided. So it's not alone. Sudan is also completely invisible and in many ways just as extreme suffering. The world's a very hard place to manage, that's for sure.
Philip Gurevich, thank you so much for your time today. That's all for today. For more reporting on major international stories, subscribe at irishtimes.com/subscribe. I'm Saoirse Pollock. This episode was produced by John Casey. In the News, we'll be back tomorrow.